Welcome back to You Hear It First, an unofficial, unfiltered history of MTV News. I'm Benjamin Wagner. For more than three decades, MTV News was where young people heard their news first. And from 1996 to 2014, I had a front row seat. These are the stories behind the stories, from the writers, reporters, correspondents, and producers who told those stories. This is You Hear It First. You Hear It First is a listener-supported podcast. Please become a supporter, producer, or sponsor at patreon.com/essentialpods right now. Your membership will help us produce the show and help you get all sorts of cool access and swag. Visit patreon.com/essentialpods right now. This week, we connect the dots between the avant-garde downtown New York art scene and the midtown corporate music media business with music and fashion writer and editor turned RuPaul co-star, one-time early days MTV News writer, Merle Ginsberg. We'll time travel with Merle from growing up, the anti-Annette Funicello in Atlantic City, New Jersey, reading, rocking, and selling her own clothes, to discovering psychedelics, experimental theater, and video art. Merle talks about sharing a scene with Laurie Anderson, Twyla Tharp, and Eric Bogosian, and seeing The Clash, Television, and Glen Branca, Danceteria, The Ritz, and Mud Club. She talks about covering the downtown art scene for The Villager and Soho News, and how she parlayed those gigs to a stint at the then-nascent MTV News, where she wrote segments for original VJs Mark Goodman, J.J. Jackson, Nina Blackwood, Martha Quinn, and Alan Hunter, before decamping to pen random notes for a certain Jan Wenner. Today, we stand beneath the marquee moon with the magnificent Merle Ginsberg.
I grew up in southern New Jersey. My dad ran hotels in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So I grew up near the beach, but I was the opposite of some little swimming beach girl. I hated going outside. I always wanted to read. I always wore dark clothes. I mean, I guess I was a goth girl. And, you know, we all have our little emotional foibles, but, you know, I've been on antidepressants since I was in my 20s, but nobody knew about them when I was a kid.
Right.
So I think a lot of that manifested in this sort of dark take on things. And I escaped into reading, into music, into making my own clothes. And that's where it all came from.
Oh, I so appreciate you saying that. 1000% music was the place that I sought refuge from the disorder or the disquiet in my house.
More than almost anything, music can be so comforting.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel less alone because most of the people making music, let's face it, are people who were loners,
right,
who were tinkling around in their bedroom like your Billie Eilish's and expressing emotions they couldn't express in any other way in music. And so I always related to the people who were making those deeper statements. I really had a hard time living on the surface. One of the things that was really happening when I was growing up in music and in culture was that people were taking psychedelic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you hear the Beatles first, and then you hear it in, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. And I was reading Aldous Huxley, and that stuff all affected me so much from a very early age.
That's substantive stuff. That is not vacuous. None of it.
You know, my parents were these incredibly nice, normal Jewish people. My father's family was from Brooklyn. My mother's from Philadelphia. They were very, very normal, good, hardworking people. But they didn't go to college. The parents didn't go to college. They had no cultural inspiration whatsoever. They watched sitcoms at night.
Right.
So I would watch them sit there at night and watch TV. And I would think, these shows are so hideous, I can't even hear them.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to find another world that's the opposite of this.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, that was black and white, and my world was color.
How did you figure out your journey and what were those early steps?
You know, it's funny even thinking about it now, but I think it really started with depression.
Mm.
In that depression drove me to feel like I don't belong anywhere. And my parents don't understand me. And I actually didn't really have a lot of good friends when I was a kid because I didn't relate to anybody. So it drove me right into books. And I started writing little stories of my own. And then I started in class projects doing puppet shows. So sixth grade, fifth grade, and we're studying history. And they're like, we want you to make your own interpretation, write a paper on whatever, you know, the Civil War. And instead of doing that, I would take these troll dolls and make little scenarios and put them on. And some people thought, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen, particularly for a school report. And other people thought, whoa, this is really entertaining and genius. Unique. And I really loved it. And some of my teachers thought, oh, this is cool. Some of them thought I was just weird. But that was probably it.
What sparked that idea? What an original, unique idea.
I don't know. You know, I've written and interviewed so many people about the creative process, right? And where the spark comes from and how it started, because it fascinates me. And I think about it in the source of my own imagination. Of course, a lot of it comes from childhood and things you read. But I think in many cases, you can't answer where it came from. You don't know.
Yeah.
It's a mystery.
It's the magic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the magic.
From grammar school and through high school, you determined that you were a writer at some point.
First, I thought that I was an actress performer, right?
Yeah.
I wrote poems. I read them aloud, sometimes to people being amused, sometimes to people thinking, what a geek.
Yeah.
Even I was thinking, what a geek. Yeah. But I really related to, you know, the Sylvia Plaths I read about and poets and whatever. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to be an actress because I relate to plays and characters in plays and some Shakespeare and some, you know, modern Hedda Gabler, like all this stuff. And I started doing plays in school and in high school, and I wrote plays. Every time somebody asked me to do any kind of school project, I wrote a play.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then I thought, well, maybe I'm a playwright. Maybe that's what I should do. But once I got to New York, I went to graduate school and I wanted to go to New York and be an actress. And I was so scared of the idea of auditioning. I had such mega fears of rejection, as we all do.
Yeah.
That I thought, you know what? Acting at that point in time was really about, as a female, the way you look. And can you sing and dance? I could never do either. So I thought, I'm never going to make it as an actress. I'm too weird looking. And, you know, now there are plenty of weird looking actresses, and not to say they're not great looking, but, you know, they're not the usual. And I thought the safer bet for me, because I love literature, is to go to graduate school in literature, get a master's or a doctorate, disappear into that magical world because I couldn't deal with the real one. And if I have to, I'll teach at college and I'll write. So that was the plan. And then I went to graduate school, which I loved, but it was in NYU. And I started going to hear like punk music. Uh-huh. And, you know, I got inspired by everything I saw and heard. And I was like, oh shit, I got to stay in New York. I'm not going to Kansas. So it's my teachers were like, you know, you're not going to get to teach at NYU unless you go to Harvard. So if you stay at NYU, you're going to teach in Kansas. And I thought, that is not happening. So I wound up taking some journalism classes at NYU. And the guy who taught the class was a journalist. And I wound up dating him, which is a pretty funny story. And he was all about music. But he made me the editor of one of the magazines. We like produced magazines.
Oh, sure.
And I thought, this is just natural for me. I grew up reading magazines. I can do this. This is what I'm doing. And there you go.
You mentioned early shows. I'm imagining CB's in its heyday. Is that right? Or can you paint a picture?
Oh, totally. But also, I'm trying to remember the name of the club, and it's pretty famous, that was right next to NYU.
Bottom Line?
It might have been, actually. But, you know, I saw like a lot of the early Brits. Yeah. Elvis Costello.
Uh-huh.
You know, that whole group of people, Lena Lovitch, it could have been the Bottom Line. I think you're right.
Well, that's right there on like 4th, I think. I mean, it's gone now, but yeah.
And also the Ritz.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Went to the Ritz. So those were the places where I felt most at home.
That sort of British punk no wave, was that your vibe or were you really taking it all in?
I was never into the hardcore Ramones. I really liked the British, Dave Edmonds, The Clash. It wasn't just fuck you music. It had artistry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Television. That was a band I loved that was American, obviously.
Oh, man, yeah.
I'm going back.
You know, by the time I got to CB's and I played it a couple of times, it was toast.
You ever listen to Marquee Moon? Tom Verlaine?
Yeah, of course.
One of my favorite records of all time. Made Absolutely. The biggest impression.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was obviously writing it when he was high on acid.
Right, right.
And it sounded like it.
And what was appealing about the idea of psychedelia to you? Was it the visual? Was it the sort of fact that you could sort of be egoless?
I had read Huxley, and one of the weirder things that's happened to me in my life was that I was, I believe, in my sophomore year of college, and my parents had, at this point, moved to the Catskill Mountains. My dad ran hotels and resorts. I had to get a job because, you know, I had to help pay for school. So I had these like front desk jobs at hotels, and I'd be like a switchboard operator, an assistant manager kind of thing. And one summer I was at this one hotel and I met these two guys who were, I don't remember where they were from, but somewhere way more sophisticated than me, you know, maybe Chicago or somewhere like that. And they were older, both really attractive. And these guys were tripping and they were waiters. I mean, they were there to make money. That's it. And get the hell out and go back to New York or wherever they live. But they had read a lot about psychedelics. They gave me books to read. They gave me Be Here Now to read. I fell in love with one of them. And they were like my only friends that summer. And they were amazing. I wish I could find them now. Yeah. That just changed my life in the biggest way. And the minute I took acid, now it was mescaline actually, because that's so much cleaner and safer. You know, it opened everything up.
You're a graduate student. You're writing for the magazine with your journalism professor. When does that become the fabric of who you are?
I found out that if you got a full-time job at NYU, then you would have, instead of four classes a semester, which would have you graduate faster, you could have two free ones.
Wow.
And so and they had a whole structure where you got out at four and you could go to class. So that's what I did. And I worked at different departments of NYU. The first one was in the acting department. So I hung out with all the actors, which I loved. And then I got another job in the graduate program of drama, which was really not about acting. It was about studying drama, right? More literary. And Richard Schechner was a professor there. He started the Garage Theater downtown, and the big star there was Willem Dafoe.
Oh,
so
right. Yeah.
Somehow I wound up writing reviews of plays around town, all small. And somebody who was a teacher there said to me, look, I can't pay you, but if you want to go to the theater every night, I run this paper and you could publish reviews of theater in it. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm so doing that. I went to plays by myself. Every night I saw Willem Dafoe do amazing avant-garde performances. And I thought, I'm not writing about Broadway. I'm writing about this interesting downtown avant-garde world. And I walked right into it.
Wow. And was that the Soho News?
That was before the Soho News, okay. But that led me to the Soho News. And there was this little paper in New York. I doubt it's still there, called The Villager.
Uh-huh.
And they dropped it on your door every week, like on a Wednesday, the same day The Village Voice came out.
Yep.
But it was very much like a free paper for the West Village. And he was the editor of that. So I got to write for them. And I'll never forget the morning my first issue came out. I ran outside. I grabbed it. I saw my byline. And I was like, okay, this is crack and I'm addicted.
Right. Oh, that is a great feeling. That's so cool.
And then I went to Soho News. I thought, well, you know, I'm an established writer. Now I had like 20 clips or something. First, I went to the New Yorker and they were so nice. They actually sat down and talked to me and they said, we really like what you're doing. You need more experience, but we'd love you to come back in a few years. So they were so, it was so encouraging that they even did that.
That is great.
And I walked in the Soho News one day. And I said, I want to be a writer and editor. And they said, well, the publisher needs an assistant. I said, okay, I'll do it.
Right. That feels familiar to me. I moved to New York City, got myself to an interview at Rolling Stone. I had a pack of 20 clips and I was like, okay, I'm ready. And they're like, yeah, they're like, we need an intern. And I was like, I'm 23 years old. What do you mean? You know, but I did it. And within 6 weeks, I was in the door and I was redlining and fact checking and then writing. So
yep, that's the root. I mean, that's the only way. I did a year of being her assistant, but within 6 months, there was somebody writing a column every week that was like free events in New York kind of thing. And she said, why don't you go back and help her so you can kind of get in the groove? So at 5 o'clock when she left and everybody was there till midnight or longer, I went back and opened all this woman's mail and looked at all the events. And she said, pick the best events and that will save me hours of work. And I did it and I loved it. And then she left.
Oh, wow. Right. And then you were ready. You slid right into the gig.
Took about a year, but yep.
Oh, it's incredible. Good for you. You're so industrious, Merle. This surprises me 0%.
That I am. And I know I've been very industrious. I've worked really hard. I hit many walls, as everyone does, right? Sure. And particularly wanting to be a writer journalist in New York. I mean, my God, there are far more no's than yes. There were many more opportunities then. There were many more publications. Of course, there was no internet. Everybody was doing newspapers and magazines and people were getting paid decently. And there were lots of jobs and it was all, that whole scene was just kind of really starting. And then of course MTV opened up and you could get jobs there. Now it's much, much harder. I do think that what kept me going is that if I wasn't involved with the worlds I was in, I was going to be so massively depressed and feeling I don't fit in anywhere. I had to find a place I fit in.
Right.
And if I didn't, I knew I'd just be depressed all the time.
It was vital. It was oxygen.
That's it.
So at some point, you are established at Soho News. Young Mikey Shore comes in. And
Mikey Shore, one of the greatest people I've ever known.
The sense I got is Soho News was like the basis for MTV News.
It kind of was. So I get there. I'm, you know, writing this column. And then they notice that, like, I'll do anything and I'll stay up all night and write things other people won't do. And then the arts editor, a woman named Tracy Young, who wound up becoming a big editor at Vogue later on, and another arts editor named Paul Slansky, who became a huge journalist in the political world. They were both super amazing people to have as an example. They kind of took me and said, okay, what do you want to write about? And I looked around and I could see that all the fields were covered. And I heard about video art and I said, well, video art, I didn't know what it was.
Right.
But I just threw myself into it. I started going to see all the performance arts, Laurie Anderson, all the performing artists. Right. And that was a world nobody was covering. And then I fell in love with it. Michael Shore, I can't call him anything but Mikey at this point, was sitting very near me. He was the most loving, delightful human. He knew more about music than anyone I've known then or since.
Yeah.
And he and I went to see every band everywhere.
Oh, cool.
He took me under his wing. I just loved going.
Yeah.
And we were both single and there was never any romantic anything. Michael taught me about Sun Ra and, yeah, you know, world music. And nobody was even thinking like that then. And we would go see bands every night. And I had this column and I could say, this is what's going on at this club. And, you know, this is who's playing here. And we went to Danceteria and we went to the Mud Club and, you know, we saw REM really early.
My heart.
I know. I just feel so lucky that I met those people, that I fell into that world because it made me who I am.
And Mud Club for REM is like what, 81?
80, oh, early, 82? Early.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is
early. That might have been Danceteria. I mean, I was the video curator of the Mud Club.
So yeah. You were responsible for what was on screens?
I was friends with this guy named Ed Solomon, who I still correspond with on, you know, social media. And he got into the music video thing right around the time MTV was starting. And it was all about the clubs. He would go around and get all these videos from British and American artists and get them into the clubs because there was no MTV.
Right.
And so we would see them in the clubs and that's how we fell in love with all these bands. And I said, I'm going to have a video program at the Mud Club. Can I show your videos? And he was like, sure. So that's how that happened.
Wow.
And people loved to watch rock videos.
Oh my gosh,
I wanted to go working at MTV because I knew everything about the music video scene.
Hey, it's Benjamin. Nearly 40% of U.S. adults report symptoms of anxiety and or depression. And 60% of young people say they feel completely overwhelmed. So I set out to document what was happening and what can be done. My new film, Friends and Neighbors, features insights and action from actual friends and neighbors like State Senator Sarah McBride, Workgroup CEO Logan Herring, former Director of Community and Family Services for Delaware Alana Berry, plus some of the educators, medical and mental health experts, activists and authors who are helping heal our anxious and uncertain communities. And I'm screening Friends and Neighbors throughout Mental Health Awareness Month in May. Each 70-minute screening features Q&A with my friends from the film, and you can find theaters, tickets, and showtimes at friendsandneighbors.mov. Hope to see you at a theater near you soon. Now back to the pod.
Freelancers came and went at the Soho News. One of them was Stu Cohn, who I'm sure you know
a lot
about.
I remember Stu well, yeah.
A very fast friend of mine. We were like stuck together like glue. And Jeff Peisch, I don't know exactly where his music journalism background came from, but he was a freelance music writer who came into the Soho News and did some projects. He was very tall and smart and very good looking. And of course, I wanted to go out with him. So I did. So we dated for a while, a couple months. But I thought he was the greatest guy. And cut to, we're at the Soho News for 2 years. We're all like living our greatest lives. Never going home. You know, you come to work at like 11 a.m. and wear your cool new way of clothes and go to clubs at 9 and come home at 5. The next thing you know, MTV has started and he becomes the news director of MTV.
Okay.
At the same time that happened, the Soho News folded, like shut down. We're devastated. Like what? We have to go into like the straight world now? We have to go uptown? This is a nightmare. So my first call was to Jeff Peisch, like saying, could I write some news? And he's like, yeah, absolutely. And Stu Cohn, this other music writer, and I wound up writing MTV News.
Jeff was one of the early hires. And who would, like Bob Pittman? Who the heck hired him? This is pre-Doug Herzog,
Bob
right?
Bob Pittman was his boss. He was the big boss.
Yeah.
And John Sykes.
Yep.
A lot of the other people there were extremely corporate.
These were AOR guys, right? Radio guys.
Pittman and Sykes were really running things and they were very smart people. I mean, look what they went on to do.
Yeah.
And nice people, you know, and they got it. They got who was talented. And I don't know what their relationship was to the whole business. I'm sure that was a big part of what they did, but they could relate to the arty types. Whereas right. a lot of guys came from radio.
Right. Right.
And we're not talking FM radio. We're talking AM radio, which was just as corporate and on the take and that old school culture and sexism and all of that. Yeah. This guy came in who was from the radio world. And he was, in my long career, the only sexual harassment issue I ever had to deal with. Eventually it came out and he got fired.
Good.
And the lucky thing for all of us is that the man who replaced him is like an angel sent from heaven, Doug Herzog.
Will you give me some first impressions when you got there from Soho News?
There were a lot of really cool people there. Stu and I were like this. I remember us sitting together in a corner and we were just in our own world because we were from the journalism world, the media.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were from radio. You know, I looked at these VJs and I thought, these people are very straight-laced. They are not from the world I'm from. They are not the kind of people who would read the Soho News.
Yeah, they're not downtown.
And yet I became friendly with all of them.
They were
all really nice people. I loved Martha. She was a doll. I loved Nina. Mark was really cool. Alan and JJ. They were all really nice and easy to work with.
And at that time, they were reading your news, right? That was the face
Absolutely.
Of news.
And,
yeah. It was less branded and basically between videos, sort of interstitial.
Oh, yeah. It was just there to fill in between the videos. You know, what's interesting is that Stu and I, so we started like, okay, what are we going to do segments on? They're going on tour. Sure. But anybody could write that. Then we started to get on the phone with the early directors of the music videos, Julian Temple. All of these guys became huge directors.
Yeah.
the guys who became 10cc.
Wow.
Yeah. Godfrey and Cream.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they were big video directors. I think they worked together even at that point. And then they were 10cc. And it's like, oh my God, these guys are rock stars now. We were on the phone with them all the time. There was no Zoom or no computers. And we just loved these guys. And we developed friendships with them. When they would come to New York, they would come and hang out with us. And we were the only people writing about this. And we knew that this was going to evolve into a big thing, that it was going to change music forever. And we knew that these guys were going to wind up directing commercials and really being big in the film world. But nobody else seemed to get it.
It's so interesting that the way that you got into video art was by assessing the opportunities at Soho News, but that ended up being so fortuitous.
You're right. I didn't even think about that.
Can you share a little bit, because it's almost abstract even for me, and I watched MTV from the second it went on air. What constituted video art at the time? Because nobody was creating for screens in the way that was happening at that point.
We all grew up watching normal television, three networks. We knew what the formula was. News, sitcoms,
yeah.
Procedural cop yeah. dramas. Johnny Carson at the end of it.
Yeah.
We never thought about the true visual possibilities. And not only that, the ways to create effects in right, video right. weren't even invented.
Right.
And the kind of editing tools that started to happen at that time. I never thought video and art had anything to do with each other. But I met these people who would come in and give me a press release and they'd say, I'm doing a video art show at some downtown gallery and I want you to write about it. And I'd say, well, I need to see it. I'd go over there and I'd see it and I'd be like, oh my God, they're taking normal television and making it into visual art.
Right.
And incorporating music. And of course, Nam June Paik, a very famous video artist, is one of the people who created video art. He took TVs and smashed them up and put different effects on them and programming and was in the Whitney Museum. I mean, he's probably very collected artist at this point. He became very major, but I only knew it was something nobody else was doing mm-hmm. and or covering. And so it was an opportunity for me. And as it grew, you know, my career grew because people would say, oh, you're the only one who knows about this.
Right.
And then I became friends with this amazing couple who I still know both of these people. They're not together. John Sanborn and Kit Fitzgerald. And if you look them up, you will find that they were very early video pioneers and got very involved with music. And they had stuff in the Whitney. They were both friends with Twyla Tharp, David Byrne, just amazing. They crossed over
right.
from the artists to people who were taking it to a bigger context. And they gave me a birthday party one year because they had this big loft downtown near the Mud Club. And they were making real money at the time. And the coolest people I ever met. And they were very involved with the music scene, the kind of Glenn Branca, Rhys Chatham. But the downtown music avant-garde scene was something I covered completely in the Soho News. And I got, look, some very big names came out of that world. Eric Bogosian.
Uh-huh, sure.
He was doing performance art all the time.
Yeah.
Steve Buscemi. Okay, he was doing that. We were friends with all these people.
Yeah.
Robert Longo, brilliant artist, was making art out of all of that. He made a picture out of me. I am a Robert Longo, which is just the craziest thing that ever happened to me. All this scene was happening. John and Kit were almost at the center of it because they made videos for all these music people. I don't know if you've heard of this guy named David Van Tiegum. He was really early on avant-garde musician in New York. I'm sure he's still there and he's still doing it, who was a drummer, but he took percussion to another level. And he did percussive performances and reinvented the way you use drumming. And he worked with John and Kit and did a lot of video stuff with them. And there were a couple of music labels at the time that started recording all these things. And it was this whole avant-garde music world. Steve Reich was kind of part of that world. And Philip Glass
sure.
was part of that world. So we knew all these people. It's kind of crazy. A lot of these clubs, Danceteria, and I think the Mud Club did this too. And later on, the Peppermint Lounge played music videos right. at the club. So you're dancing. And the way we're learning how to dance and figuring out how to dance to this music is by watching the bands and the dancers in the videos and seeing what they're doing. And of course, a lot of it came from London. And so it's like, oh my God, look at, this is the coolest thing that's happening. You know, we got to do this. If you're dancing to the Clash, there's only a certain way you can move.
Right.
And we got it off in the videos. But the technology was definitely the seed of it all. I mean, the fact that there was cable television.
Right.
I mean, we haven't even gotten into that. There were three networks for years.
Sure.
Suddenly there's cable and there's all these channels and you could have an MTV. And MTV wasn't on in New York when I started working there. Honestly, I'm not sure I'd watched any of it when Jeff hired me to write music news. I don't think I had, because you couldn't see it.
Right.
But in the office, they would play it. And so that's how we got familiar with it. And there was no format. Like, of course, they were running videos, but they needed the VJs to speak in between. Kurt wasn't there yet. It was the VJs reading the news.
Right. And did you write for the specific VJs, or did you write broadly not knowing who would read it, or did you have voice for Martha?
I don't think we knew who would read it.
And it turned enterprise pretty quickly because you were interviewing directors, right? You weren't just regurgitating whatever was released. You were adding,
as it
were.
We did that, believe me. We did that at first, like this band's going on tour and blah, blah, blah. But then once MTV came on in New York, you know, it grew and grew and grew exponentially, like very, very quickly. And people were watching that more than they were reading magazines at a certain point. And so the news became an important element.
Yeah.
And we had to cover the things the magazines weren't covering.
Do you remember an early assignment? Like, at what point did you begin to, if at all, go out into the field and start shooting talent?
When it came to interviewing bands, sometimes Stu and I, because we were the people there who knew the music better than anybody, would interview talent. But mostly the talent would come into the studio and be interviewed.
Talk to JJ
by the
Nina.
DJs. I think that Stu and I, and probably other people there in other departments, helped write all the questions.
Right.
It's not like you could go online and read about these bands. There were no computers. That was years later. So, you know, how did you do research? Well, you went to back issues of Rolling Stone. You read all the music magazines. You called their manager. And it was much harder than to do it now. And yeah, I mean, look, the VJs were... Certainly Mark was on the radio in LA, and I think JJ too. They knew a lot about the kind of music that was happening. Doug came in. We were so relieved. And one day I heard that a job was open at Rolling Stone to write Random Notes, which was the front of the book and a very famous novel.
Yes.
And I knew who those writers were. I didn't know them at all. I knew it was Kurt. I knew there was Chris Connolly. I knew David Frick, lovely guy.
Yeah.
Great writer. I knew those guys. Later on, I knew Anthony DeCurtis, another fantastic guy.
Legends and all.
Oh, absolutely. And I heard about this job and I thought, they're never going to hire me. I mean, I thought it was a joke. But I kept calling and I got this nice guy on the phone who was just a receptionist. And I kept saying, I really like to apply. And he said, well, send me your stuff. So I sent him a bunch of MTV News stuff and Village Voice stuff and whatever. Nothing happened. And like, I don't know, 3 months go by and they call me and they go, you want to come over for an interview? And I'm like, this is a laugh. I'm just going to say whatever I want because they're never going to hire me. So instead of being like doing what I thought they would want, I just did me.
Yeah.
I just thought, I'm going me. And that is an instinct, I have to say, that's always worked for me. Because either people get it or they don't. Either they're like, we don't want anything to do with this person, or that's our kind of person. And I mean, there were like five editors in the room interviewing me. I think I had four interviews.
Wow.
And I was sure David Frick was a freelancer at that point, that he was the person they would hire. Right. In fact, when I first called, they said, oh, the job's gone, you know, and I thought, oh, they hired David Frick. Well, that makes complete sense. Maybe he didn't want that job. I don't know. But the job remained open. And I did those four interviews. And I kept thinking, why are they calling me back? But I I think the thing that cinched it in the left, two things. One of them was the typical, I hope old school at this point, question, where do you want to be in 5 years? And I thought, I'm not going to fake this shit. And I said, I don't know, wherever the next 4.5 takes me. And I thought probably nobody answered it honestly.
Yeah.
You know, like, do I have my life mapped out in my 20s? I don't think so. And they appreciated that honesty. And also, I was sure they would never hire a female. that they never, ever, ever would. And no woman had done that job. They said to me, I knew who Jan Wenner was. I knew all the stuff. They said, what would you do if the big boss comes barreling down the hallway and screams at you and throws a complete fit and you did nothing wrong? And this could happen a lot.
Wow.
And I went, oh, honey, I worked in the Catskills at hotels. That that rolls off my back. I think that's what did it. My first day there, they put me in this lovely office. I've got a word processor. I don't know how to use it. I'm looking down at Fifth Avenue going, I can't even believe this is happening. Jan Wenner comes barreling down the hallway as predicted and says, I know who you are. I said, oh, it's so great to meet you. And I'm so thrilled to be here. And he said, you know how I want to deal with random notes? And I said, no, please inform me. And he said, not at all. And he marched away.
That sounds in character.
Yeah, I should really write a book about it. But going back.
Yes, you should. And I would like a signed copy and I will be at the signing. And please.
Thank you.
Yes,
that's encouraging.
1,000%.
Going back, I knew that this apparently wonderful man named Doug Herzog was coming in to be the news director. And nobody had heard anything but wonderful things. And I wanted to meet him. And he came in and he's like, I've heard great things about you. I'm going to promote you and Stu. You're going on staff. You're going to be my team. And I was like, Doug, I hate to tell you, if you'd shown up 2 days before, I would have signed up, but I got an offer to go to Rolling Stone. He's like, you got to take it.
Oh, wow.
He's like, it breaks my heart. And I don't want to tell you that, but yeah. You got to take it.
Yeah.
And so I went. And then Stan Mikey was hired later on.
You cut your teeth at Soho News and MTV News. What sort of legacy does it have in your career, which is long and luminous and storied? It sounds like it was a fairly formative moment in your growth and development.
Totally beyond. This morning, I was talking to someone who wrote a book about the downtown art world, which was Soho News, period. And it was also making me completely reappreciate how lucky that I burst into that world without even knowing what I was doing and, you know, how magical it was. But if I had to have some corporate job, I could never have gone and worked at a record company. I could never have done that. If I couldn't wear green nail polish to work, I wasn't going. Some of it had to do with the way you dressed. And I, you know, was out there doing fishnets and punk, and I didn't look crazy, but I certainly didn't look like somebody's assistant uptown. And I was never going to. And I figured out there's only certain paths for me. Like if I'm not in this world, A, I'll be miserable, and B, nobody else is going to hire me. The wonderful thing about it is that I learned so much about music. And music was my entire world at that time. And the art world of, like, you know, performing the arts and all of that. Like anything that related to something unique and cultural. And I did go on to write for much more, I wouldn't say grown up, but, you know, and I wouldn't say corporate, but glossy, more mainstream places. But somehow I always wound up in sort of the right place.
When you think about your career in context to the young puppeteer, what lesson would you share back with her today?
That's the best question ever. I would say, go with your instincts. And I think if you're a creative person and you have issues of like, I don't know, I've always thought that depression and creativity, not that you have to be depressed to be creative, but I do think that generally depressive people, you know, are not in the normal world or wind up becoming creatives in some way. I was a kid. All I wanted to do was read books. I didn't have any friends. And, you know, I would say to that person, like, don't worry about it. Like someday the things you care about, a lot of other people are going to care about too. Someday the way you dress is going to be a big fashion movement. Someday all the things you think about yourself and how weird you think you are going to be rewarded. Well, who would think?
You Hear It First is an Essential Industries production, a boutique creative and consulting firm in beautiful Wilmington, Delaware. Please become a supporter, producer, or sponsor at patreon.com/essentialpods today. Please rate and review us on your favorite platform. It'll help us improve the show and help others to find it. Visit friendsandneighborshow.com to listen to previous episodes and subscribe to our newsletter. And I'd love to hear from you. Drop me an email at benjaminbwagner@gmail.com. Until next time, remember, what's essential is invisible to the eye.